1913, when Aram Khachaturian was 10 years old, his parents moved from their mobile dacha in the Caucasus Mountains of eastern Armenia to Atlantaski, a village in the Russian Republic of Georgia. In fact, they didn't move so much as they escaped. They had to leave their homeland, their friends, and their prized collection of kapok goats simply because of Mr. Khachaturian's countenance. His bushy eyebrows, big mustache, and extra ear made him the spitting image of Joseph Stalin.
Could have given his extra ear to Van Gogh.
But
was it the other side?
It was somewhere else entirely.
Oh, okay.
Haven't you ever seen pictures of Joe Stalin with the third ear?
The third ear?
Yes.
Oh, right. Yes, I have. Yes. Now that you remind me.
Ever since the young revolutionary had been exiled to Siberia by the Tsarist government, any similarities to him, either written or implied, were persona non grata. The day before the Khachaturians fled, Imperial thugs had rounded up nearly 100 men who were milling around outside their trailer. Even though they bore only a slight resemblance to Stalin, they were nonetheless hauled off to an abattoir and never seen again. Because Papa Khachaturian had to keep a low profile for the foreseeable future, it was up to Mama to find work. And thanks to her unique titanium hair, she was hired right away by a local beauty shop to head the henna research program. They lived in a two-room flat above the Zod Balalaika factory, which was a real treat for Aram. No matter his grade school guidance counselor had sanctioned a career in meatpacking for him, Aram found himself enchanted by the sounds of the stringed instruments as they filtered up from the workshop below. Occasionally, an itinerant ashug, or minstrel poet, would stop by the factory to jam with the factory strummers, and Aram would spend hours with his ear next to the floor to better hear the improvisational word-music interplay.
Just about make out those balalaikas back there.
Yeah, they're faint, but there they are. In spite of Mama's good job, the winter of 1913 was a hard one, and the family was forced to subsist on a proletarian diet of carrots and blancmange. The Zod factory, too, fell on hard times. The Tsar's mistress was said to have received a mild shock from a balalaika while trying to play it in her bathtub, and soon thereafter the instrument was banished from the palace. As a result, the Zod merchandise quickly fell out of favor with the people of Atlantaski, and the company was forced to retool its machine shop to manufacture a commodity that was once again in vogue, sabers. While the sounds that attend the construction of a saber may not seem to be on the same musical level as those that pervade a balalaika factory, Aram nevertheless developed a fondness for them. The rhythmic hammering, the soldering iron squeals, the buzz from the arc lamps, the clank of metal against metal as the products were tested under combat conditions. Together, they made an exciting wash of sound that would stay with him long after the Zod factory switched from swords to dried flowers and potpourri. 29 years later, when Aram, now a famous composer, wrote the score to the Gayan Ballet, he would incorporate those hammers, squeals, buzzes, and clanks into one of the dances, his most popular piece, the fiery saber dance. Years and some odd days later at 2:05 on a Saturday morning.
I was sure you were going to add an extra beat or two to that in the middle.
Well, bring it back up.
Just let it go.
Yes.
Oh, well.
I didn't have enough time to work it all out, but it may come back as a reprise. Yeah. 58 years and some odd days later, at 2:05 on a Saturday morning, that is the sound that greets me as I slowly open the hatch. The notes cascade upon one another as if the piece is depicting a melee among rival factions of dust mites. As you could bring it up just for a moment. But then I realize that the confusing reverberation is simply due to its originating from a long way down another corridor. This one, also dimly lit, seems to be made of metal, based on the zinc aromatherapy that surrounds me. I clamber out of the previous tunnel, close the hatch, and gather my wits, which I have strewn all over the metal floor. The music abruptly ceases, and as I strain to hear any sound that might give me a clue as to my present situation, a distant dog bark? An arc lamp buzz? The flapping of a large winged creature? Anything! I intuitively know that further details are not in the cards for this...
Not poker, not tarot.
Nope. For this 290th episode of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar.
Award-winning bazaar.
And that the soundest course of action would be to turn over the Saber Dance-free festivities to Calvos.
Why, and here he is. Festive.
Festive, yeah.
Festive, our 290th festiveness. That word is impossible to speak. Let's listen to a little Edward Artemyev. We'll be back to be festive.
That's us.
Festive. Music by the legendary Russian composer Edward Artemyev. This is a brand new release from Electroshock. We just received a packet of CDs from his son Artemy Artemyev from Moscow just yesterday in the big packet in the mail. It was so nice to get.
And we'll be interviewing him as soon as we get the budget for the Russian.
No, actually, Artemy Artemyev is sending us some radio art.
Oh, good.
Which he's going to tell us stuff about the Western Russian musical scene and sort of interesting stuff. He'll be sending that along in January. So
oh, fine.
Yeah, he's putting together a long-distance interview, so to speak.
Fine. Just a quick note, I've been hauled onto the
what?
Proverbial pronunciation carpet again, the ballet that Mr. Khachaturian wrote for in 1942 is, in fact, the...
Oh, Guyana.
Guyana.
Yeah,
Guyana.
Guyana. Ballet. Yes, ballet.
Ballet.
Ballad, yes, the Ballad of the Guyanist. Ah, and Saber Dance, yes, Saber
yes.
Dance. That much was right.
Thanks.
Anyway, Edward Artemyev, that we just heard, was Noosphere, from a brand new release called A Book of Impressions. That's he was a film composer for many years, and these are remixes of some of his work that he did himself. So, Edward Artemyev, Noosphere. Let's listen to some from this new batch of CDs from Moscow on Electroshock. Let's listen to from Ansiana, music by Stanislav Krejci. This is the Ocean Triptych. Stanislav Krejci.
Thank you. Thank you.
On the electroshock label from Moscow, that's Stanislav Krejci, and that's the triptych Ocean. CD's called Anciana, and you just can't get it here. Actually, you can get them online. They are available if you can. I think there's some economic gymnastics you have to go through to pay for them, but you can get them. Electroshock is a label. We'll have more to play from that label. We've got a half dozen new ones here.
And I think it's very instructive to hear the references to saber dance in that piece.
Yes, could you hear them?
I could.
Yes, particularly the rhythmic character.
Exactly.
Yes. We have lots of new stuff that has arrived. Here's one from Sarah Peebles.
We should also note that in only about 7 or 8 minutes,
yes,
we will have the conclusion of our interview with Brenda Hutchinson.
Correct. Correct. And I didn't mention that. How forgetful of me.
No, but we'll play it.
Yes. Well, it's lots of fun because we'll hear more of her, how do you get to Carnegie Hall.
Yes.
The live performance, and we'll hear something from Violet Flame. And this wonderful thing recorded in the asylum called Voices of Reason.
Yes.
Yeah. So for the moment, leading up to the top of the hour, here's The Curse of Border Vacuums, Part 1. This is music of Sarah Peebles from a brand new CD called Insect Groove.
Oh, I know about insects and vacuums.
Yes, you do. The Cluster Flies.
Yes.
Curse of the Border Vacuums at Cluster Flies.
Thank you. Welcome from rain-swept Manchester and sunny Vermont. This is David Solomons, and you're listening to Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, your red alert for new music.
He knows how to say red alert.
Spoken like a native.
Yes, here on WGDR Plainfield. Ah, that was fun. Before that, Sarah Peebles from her new released CD, The Insect Groove. Mm-hmm. That was Curse of Border Vacuums, Part 1. What fun. Well, time for...
Last... No, I have to prepare.
Time for Brenda Hutchinson.
Of course, that's right.
We'll go back to the Bregman Studios at Dartmouth College and pick up with a little excerpt from the long piece of Voices... Violet Flame. And a little bit of that. We played an extended excerpt last week, and then we'll go back to the interview itself.
Fine with me.
Ready?
Well, hit it.
No, I won't hit it because I've got to put it in the CD player so that I can mix it properly.
I see.
I just realized I was in the mixless CD. We can't have that. All right, here we go. Violet Flame, excerpt from Music Collagification by Brenda Hutchinson.
Well, I certainly admire the work that my mother and father have done. Many people believe the things that the media has said, and that hurts me. I'd like for people to know my mother and father as I've known them. And I've seen them in every possible situation, you know, since I was a child, and they were both extremely hardworking in the founding and the formation of this organization. And they put every bit of themselves that was available and more into it. They have been expressed a great deal of love and helped many people in their lives and generosity. They've been an example to me of walking that path of a reunion with God. One that I sometimes feel, you know, unable to follow in every way. You know, they both wear very, very, you know, big shoes.
Mommy loves God.
I couldn't possibly do what God has done here. God has done this, and I feel that I am His servant. I obey His commandments to me. I have a profound oneness with Jesus, the Sacred Heart of Jesus, the Immaculate Heart of Mary.
In the name of our beloved Mighty I Am Presences and Holy Christ Self, we call forth the presence of beloved Paul the Venetian, the Ascended Master Nicholas Rorick, all angels of art and of the handcrafts to come forth and join us.
A messenger being someone who receives by the Holy Spirit the teachings and the directions of the Ascended Masters. And Ascended Masters are just people like you and me who have passed their tests in life, and whose souls have transcended the necessity to have a physical body and be on earth. So they are spiritual masters, but very tangible and very real.
And we accept this then right now in full power in the name of Christ. Amen.
Amen.
Okay.
Everything is different.
There's so many restrictions. I mean, you cannot eat sugar. There's a lot of things you cannot wear red. You cannot wear black. You cannot wear orange. I can see the point.
From Violet Flame by Brenda Hutchinson, our guest today on Calvos and Damien.
A lot of your work, even from the beginning, what you first started talking about was the voice. Mm-hmm. What's your fascination with that?
A number of things. I guess there's a certain, I've never been particularly interested in pitch as a composer, in the sense of, stick scales and things like that. I really like sort of the inflection and rhythm and the finer gradations in speech as a purely abstract thing. And when you listen to someone speaking another language, you can really hear that much better. So that's on the one hand. The other hand is I like stories, I'm not interested in breaking speech up and drawing attention to the different phonemes and different things about speech so much as I am in the complete context, because
so you're not a decontextualizer at all.
And I think the voice, especially when it's talking about something that is meaningful to whoever's speaking, there's a lot of truth sort of there. And it's unfortunate that words kind of occupy the first part of your perception, because it kind of obscures that, but I still am interested in that, and that's why I do it and what I'm sort of trying to pull out when I do these things.
That probably was started in Trenton when you were there, or Trenton.
Trenton.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Trenton.
Yeah.
One reaction that I had when listening to this was some of them, and this has had to do, this is a reaction I also had in listening to Jesus' Blood Never Failed Me Yet, and the reaction to Richard Avedon's photos from across America is the voyeuristic aspect of it. Do you have any reactions to that when you're doing it? Do you feel like you're a voyeur? And when you're editing it, do you pull back from that? Or do you feel that you have somehow helped the expression?
I don't feel like a voyeur because, for the most part, I spend a long periods of time with people that I record. When the Voices of Reason, I was there for 2 years, 2 days a week. And I feel... And people always know that they're being recorded and they're willing participants in it. And I feel like they want to do it and that they're getting something out of it. The editing part is very strange. I noticed this first with my grandmother, because I spent so much time listening to her on tape, and then when I talked to her on the phone, it was like, is it live or is it memorized? And she would say the same things that she would say on tape, and it made her not real. In a funny way. And the other thing is, when you're spending so much time, sometimes years will go by that I'll work on something, or I'll continue to perform it, it's sort of like it's very much like a photograph, in that those people are frozen in time. And when I'm no longer there, our relationship is completely has departed from that point. But I'm still intimately involved in something that isn't even real anymore, and that's really strange. I just live with it.
You mentioned Voices of Reason, and I think we should have a listen to that. That was recorded, as I understand, in a New York State psychiatric hospital.
Mm-hmm, yeah, Bronx State.
Bronx State. And what was your capacity there? You certainly were no candy striper.
Oh no, I did it with full permission of everyone there. I spent a year getting access to a locked ward at Bronx State. I was working in outpatient clinics and things like that, and I finally ran into someone who was an administrator. I'll say all this. It was an administrator at Bronx State, and she had just come back to her office every year, and this was 1982 to 84 was when I did this recording, and every year they would need to be certified by the state, and at that time they would rent plants and paintings, and they would bring people up from the administrative offices and put them on the ward so they would have more staff up there. And the inspectors would come, and they would pass the inspection, and then they would send the people back down.
Such every institution.
And send the plants back, send the paintings back. And so it was after one of these inspections that I got permission to go up there. And I went up 2 days a week, Tuesday and Wednesday, and in the morning I had a little, one of the little organs that have like the black and white push buttons in one hand and like two octaves in the other.
M&E organs.
And I'd sit there with that on my lap, and we would do old Protestant hymns, Christmas carols, and show tunes.
Mm-hmm. And then we do Christmas carols all year long.
Silent Night in particular. That was the main one. And then in the afternoon, I would come back up with my recorder. I had a TCP-5 cassette machine and a little mic, and I would record people, and they would listen back, and we'd spend the afternoon that way. So I did that for 2 years, and then I finally stopped.
Do you know if they were getting any therapy from what you were doing?
Well, they got cigarettes.
Oh, that's good.
Spent time with me, they'd get cigarettes. To buy cigarettes for a nickel. And, they liked to do it. I mean, they hung out. When I was there, people came and hung out. So, and when I left, this is like something you think of in a movie, but when I left, and I told people I was leaving and I wasn't going to be back. It's like my last week. People lined up. And usually when, I'd record somebody, when I was done, I'd give them the headphones and then they could listen. Sometimes they would talk and listen at the same time. But this time they didn't even want to listen. It was like the next person just wanted to stand there and just stand in front of me, not even sit down. Just stand in front of me and like, there was one woman just stand there and she held them. I said her own thing and then when she was done, it was next, just like that. Hmm. Yeah, I used to get on out of there and I'd get on the number 6 train and I'd fall asleep right away. It was really intense.
Exhausting.
And then I'd wake up the other end and I'd go, whoa, I couldn't stop talking, Yeah, so.
Well, let's listen to some of it because there's a lot of talk in there.
Oh, yes.
This is excerpts from Voices of Reason by Brenda Hutchinson, our guest on Calvus and Damien.
And that wasn't on.
All the stories we were telling.
This one that we can do.
So going to get some other things to do.
Yeah.
This is Kennedy with Scott, the
sign
of the key of E.
I would like to.
That wasn't honest.
Yeah, well, old stories we were telling with the machine off. Okay, that was from Voices of Reason by Brenda Hutchinson. Let's go back to All Roads again.
Okay.
How did you, how much of what we're going to hear tonight is written down and how?
I guess I'll explain how the score works.
Sure.
All the recorded material, I decided that I wanted everyone to be in the piece that I recorded, all the stories, all the performances, in some way or another. And so I created a set of 7 CDs that go with the score, and there's 5 sections to the piece. And they're divided among, you know, stories and performances and the various things. And every track of the CD has a page of score associated with it, and it tells you what's on that track on one half, and the other half are suggestions for how to play along, when to play, when to listen, but also the style of playing, or, you know, so it's only based on the performer's memory, preference, and experience. So you don't even have to know how to play the piano, because there's a lot of CD tracks with people playing that don't know how to play. So there's something there for every performer. And what sort of I found to sort of kind of emerge from that is it's like a portrait of the performer at that time, because they choose all the ones they like. And the sad thing for me is when it's like one performer, you only hear like 5 things or 6 things on the whole, and you have no idea sort of the scope of the piece. But the performance tonight, there are 5 performers, and so you get to hear more, a little more. But they have a very definite kind of classic bent. I mean, so this every performance is really different, and it's very much reflects who the performers are. So there are no written. There's a suggestion of one note. An E, and it's in Furlies, and it's the note that they're all struggling to find.
Yes, right.
You know, and I just put it in just for fun.
So, when this is performed, we hear people playing. Do we hear people speaking as well?
Mm-hmm.
So they're reading, and the CD parts. Those are both playing and speaking.
Oh, there's no reading. I mean,
but that's what I mean.
The CDs are both. I organize like the first one that you heard. First one that you'll hear is mostly like one liners that people said about the piano. Like, mm-hmm. So I got a lot of people in there.
And so these are the original people speaking. There's nobody reading
text.
Yes, all
CDs. Oh no.
So the performers tonight are only the people playing the piano.
Yes, but they have the option in part 4 to tell their own story.
Okay.
So some people do, and there's also if you don't want to tell your story, you can select other people. titles. Like, I put longer stories in there. And part two are mostly thematic things, like childhood memories, bad teachers, horrible results. I mean, you know, those are people, so they choose from that. Part three is sort of like, I call it swap. When I was in college, I went to hear Edgar Winter play, and there was a part where they were swapping, like him and the guitar player, and it was astounding. I thought, oh, this is I like this model. And so you go through all the, there's a lot, you can choose from lots of styles, but basically you kind of swap looks with the people that are performed in the truck, and or you can play along with them. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the last section of the piece, there were three, I'll let you guess, there were three sort of favorite things that people played. You want to guess what they are?
Well, if they're on the recording, I think I know, so I'll recuse myself.
Okay. Well, I heard the recording too, but I wasn't trying to pick them out. I mean, certainly Shirley's appeared right at the beginning, so everybody learns to play that right away.
That's right, that's one. Okay,
Shirley's
was.
Oh, gosh.
A lot of versions of that.
Probably a lot of versions of Chopsticks.
Chopsticks
was
the other, and there's one
yeah.
more. This
oh.
is the
all-time
favorite.
The all-time favorite? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know.
That's it.
What's it called?
Heart and Soul.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. And I taught a lot of people how to play it, too, because they like know part of it.
Yeah.
And then I play that a lot. So the last part of the piece, performers can choose from among those and then play along.
It's great. Let's hear some more of it.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
probably in Cavils and Damien time. This will be from the live performance that we're going to hear this segment coming up now.
Assuming that we do get our recording set up correctly.
Us? Correctly? Just because we've missed about eight concerts by plugging things in wrong? Here we go. To Brenda Hutchinson's All Roads, How Do You Get to Carnegie Hall? Here's some more of it. We'll be right back. That was actually from All. That wasn't All Roads. All Roads is a radio version. We were just told this is just simply called.
didn't want to go along. I was tired. But I was a nice person, so I agreed. We're driving up the steep, winding hill in the backwoods. Girl in my class. I was also taller than any of the boys in the class. And strangely enough, I was taller than the teacher in my class. So I kind of stuck out like a sore thumb. I didn't want to stick out. On top of that, I was the first one to get pimples. I didn't have just one or two nice, friendly little pimples. I had a lot of them. I had hundreds of them. All over my face. Right where everyone could see them. And my hair was a bush. Back in the days when it was very stylish to have very straight, limp hair. My hair was a bush. So I didn't have any friends. I'm not sure if it's because nobody wanted to be my friend, or if because I felt like such a plague that I didn't think I was friend material. And because I didn't have any friends, I didn't have any of those social obligations. So I had time for piano lessons. I went to Kola Haydn for piano lessons. Kola and her husband, Bernard, had come from Berlin in the 30s to get away from the political climate. Bernard was a composer, and Kola was on her way to be a concert pianist. And so I went to Kola for my piano lessons. In fact, I went 2 days a week for my piano lessons because, of course, you say I didn't have any friends, and so I had all the time to go to extra piano lessons. So I went twice a week. In fact, I might have gone 3 times a week, but something about my parents' bank account. So I would go for my piano lessons with my pimples and my hair, and I would sit at the piano, because that's what Kola called it, the piano. And she would sit on a little rickety chair right next to the piano. And when I first began my study, I didn't have any books. Kola wrote all the music herself, and she would sit there with the piano music, with the music, just writing away all sorts of things. Waltz and Dean, that was one of my favorites. I somehow got the notion that all of the piano repertoire had been written during somebody's lesson. Anyway, the day came when Kola gave me a book of music. I can still remember it, sort of that manila envelope, yellow, with the big black block letters. It said Chopin all the way across. She put the book up on the desk and began to play some of the pieces that I was going to study. And somewhere in that moment, all of a sudden, I felt as if I'd been let out of my cage. I felt as if there was room for me on the dance floor, too. I felt like maybe I could fly as well. And somewhere, all of a sudden, all those pimples didn't matter, and that hair didn't matter. And being too tall didn't matter. And it was all about some dots and dashes, little squiggles, and too much black ink in a yellow book. And my fingers on white and black keys, and an instrument that Kola called the piano.
This is the closest I've actually come to playing in a closet. I mean, I called myself a closet musician, but I never actually played in a closet. This is pretty close.
5 minutes. And then I got in the back of this U-Haul, and they had this piano inside there. And I thought that they were going to kidnap me. So I got in anyway, just to see what happened, and played the piano, and that was all.
So the piano is an interesting relic of the past. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist in the future, but it seems like music is going someplace else, so it's sort of nice.
When I was very young, I was fascinated with the piano.
And especially how we had a great piano class, and whether you used to play it, she used to play it much, much. Like she was waiting her father to go. She always get dressed before him, and she'd get all dressed, and she'd go and play it much, much. She'd say, it's a soon as you're
I always love the music.
That wasn't All Roads. All Roads is a radio version, we were just told. This is just simply called How Do You Get to Carnegie Hall. Why? All Roads is the radio version because...
Well, wow. How Do You Get to Carnegie Hall? It was done. I finished that in 1998. Okay. I performed a lot. But I wanted to make a piece that was kind of a documentary of just the perform, you know, people that I met on the road, sort of the journey. So I gave it a different name so it wouldn't be confused. It's just a 30-minute, finite, always the same sort of piece every time.
So your question is?
What do you do with your performance? What does your performance life consist of?
I didn't start performing until 1989.
Oh, no.
Because I was terrified to perform. And the first piece I performed was which is a pig call.
Oh, yes, it's a great piece. Let's wrap the show up with that. We'll put that as the last
piece. And where were you when you started your performance career? I mean, you were out of Trenton, of course.
I was out of Trenton. Yeah, I was. So that's the first piece I performed. And, at the time I decided to perform, I realized I didn't really do anything. I could do a lot of things, but nothing very well. When you're in New York, there's a very high standard to compare yourself with. So, but I had friends that had gone to Thailand. They recorded lots of things, and one of the things they recorded was a Thai woman calling her pig, and it was such an amazing sound. When they brought it back, I learned how to do it. Mm-hmm. And in the course of learning how to do it, I had just quit smoking, and when doing it, I would cough and cough and cough. My nose would run, my eyes would tear, it made me think of that thing. I mean, the association with all those sort of fluids coming out of my face. And I had a lot of people that were dying then. My grandmother had died not too long before that. And it turned into just like a lament and a thing about witnessing and testifying, the lives and deaths of people. So that was my first performance. And so ever after that, my presence usually has been pretty, that piece, I'm screaming at the top of my lungs.
Yeah.
But ordinarily, I'm more...
sedate?
Just kind of witnessing. I'm just kind of keeping company with the people who I recorded. Mm-hmm. I play the giant music box that I made and put it together and take it apart and play it. I mean, it's pretty intricate. And I don't know. Yeah. The piece that I did with my mother, I do the music box, but I also, there's a part where I sort of confess her largest sins in public. And It's very humiliating for me to do, and I feel like if she were still alive and she heard that, it would be terrible. So I feel really guilty. I was raised Catholic. So it comes natural. So I figured, somehow I needed to sort of balance the the gravity of that act of public confession of someone else's sin. So I sing. I sing an aria from Madame Butterfly, which I do very badly, and I do it in public. And so it's sort of an act of public humiliation. And so that's a kind of a different, more out there sort of, I don't like to perform. So, and then the two, I play the two, that's my thing. So it's all voice mostly. Blah, blah.
Could you give us one ululation?
Oh, geez.
Yeah. Hey, back up over there, the other side of the room.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not sure of the pitch.
Oh.
To do it again,
so
okay.
No, that's fine. I wouldn't mind having it again, but that would just be for a bonus.
Lovely
benefit.
Coda.
You're so much fun. How come your music is so serious?
I got a little. Of the Carnegie Hall pieces was serious.
I guess.
Yeah.
And the piece I just did in Minnesota wasn't serious. It was like, let's put on a show. I got cowboys and farmers to come and do poetry, and it was very fun.
What's next?
I'm going to go home.
Now, where is that? Oh, wait, you were just saying you're always on the road.
San Francisco. I go home tomorrow, and I'll be home for the holidays. This last project when I was in northern Minnesota, I recorded lots of people there also, so I'll probably do something with that.
Can you sing Home for the Holidays through the two?
I don't know that song.
Oh,
you could do it.
You want to do
it? I don't know it either. I don't know the first line.
I thought it was a movie. It is a movie.
Close enough.
Good enough.
Wow.
Brenda Hutchinson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This has been a treat.
Thank you. Thanks for coming all this way.
And now, again, the name of the piece that we're going to go out with is...
Yeah. Oh, you want me to do it?
Please.
Yeah.
By Brenda Hutchinson.
Yeah.
Angel. I believe in the Lord. July 4th, 1987. Peter Gunlock, son of Robert Step of K, brother Bob, Karen, Cindy, and Mary, husband of Lisa, father of Shady Mocha, Rick, and Lucy, my brother-in-law. November 1988, John Burns, son of John, senior, Merrill, brother of Kathy and Chris, step of the December 21st, 1988, Barry Valentino, son of Barry Sr. and Jean, brother Scott, Mark, and Lisa Ann's friend, my friend. February 1985, Frank Oppenheimer, brother of Robert Holt, husband of Jackie Emily, father of Michael, our friend. May 1987, Henrietta Grand, mother of Ian and Ross Allen, my friend. March 17, 1988, Edward McEllis, brother of William, Jim, May, and Peggy, father of Shirley, Albie, and Geraldine. April 1988, Ruth Magnani, wife of Franco, friend of father, me. October 1988, Morgan Schumick, father of Barbara, husband of Elsie, Barbara's dad. August 22nd, 1985, Irene Gellis-Atulio, sister of Millie, Margaret, D'Antoni, Ida, Dominic, Mariscat, Alvira, and Joe, wife of William, mother of Mary Ann, grandmother of Lisa and Billy. July 4th, 1987, Peter Gunlock, son of Robert Step of K, brother of Bob, Karen, Cindy, and Mary, husband of Lisa, father of Shady Mocha, Rick, and Lucy. November 1988, John Burns, son of John, Sr. and Marilyn, brother of Kathy and Chris, step of Brenda, Lisa, and Billy. December 21st, 1988, Barry Valentino, son of Barry Sr. and Jean, brother Scott, Mark, and Lisa, Ann's friend. February 1985, Frank Oppenheimer, brother of Robert, husband of Jackie and Millie, father of Michael. May 1987, Henrietta Grant, mother of Ian and Mom Sally. March 17, 1988, Edward McEvoy, brother of William Jim, and Peggy, father of Shirley, Albie, and Geraldine, father of Pat. 1988, Ruth Magnani, wife of Franco, friend of Bob. October 1988, Morgan Schumann. Father, Barbara, husband, Elsie. Kidney failure. I'm going to go to the hospital.
Howard Burt. You're listening to Calvos and Damian's New Music Bazaar. You're red alert for new music.
Here on WGDR Plainfield.
When did he do that?
He did that for us when we did all the IDs.
Oh, fine.
He did two versions. He did a quiet version and an enthusiastic version.
Yes, that was the witch.
That was the quiet version.
Okay.
Before that, we heard E-Yah.
Yeah.
E-Yah by Brenda Hutchins. Thank you for all your enthusiastic phone calls, by the way. We've had a record number of excited listeners calling in today for Calvos
and Damian. Same person, though, wasn't it?
No, of course not.
But no. People calling for other people.
Well,
but
enthusiastic people.
Yes, indeed.
Before that, we heard the live performance of How Do You Get to Carnegie Hall by Brenda Hutchinson.
Including Tales From.
Yes, including, well, let's do the whole credit list.
Fine.
It was performed by Christopher Carroll, Jackie Jacobus, Nora Jacobson, Daniel Weiser, and Christian Wolfe at the Bregman Studios at Dartmouth College. And the stories you heard were told by Nora Jacobson first and Jackie Jacobus second.
I see.
Live performance there at the Faulkner Recital Hall.
And they say contemporary music doesn't have anything to say.
Well, did they mean words? Is that what they meant?
That's what they mean.
Oh, well, speaking of words, we had some fun. Might as well take a little break here since we haven't talked about it. We had a little fun on Wednesday. We drove down to New York City and got gold medals put around our necks.
Yes, and little hors d'oeuvres.
Well, you had the hors d'oeuvres. I waited until it was over, and then they were all gone.
That's your hard luck.
I suppose it was.
And what was the award again?
The ASCAP Deems Taylor Award. These are presented in various fields of music journalism, so to speak, over the course of a year. A group of judges get together and decide that interesting things have been done and who to give them to, like an article in Smithsonian Magazine about custom-made musical instruments, and the producers of several programs on Black Entertainment Television, the executives of that organization were there. Who else? Oh, there was also WFUV at Fordham got a special award. And,
yeah, for having the longest presentation.
Who else? Good.
There was the MTVI News, the internet version of MTV.
Right. They shared the internet award with us. We got the concert music one, and they got the popular music one.
There were people from the New York Times, Madison Magazine, Jazz Times, NARAS Journal.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned Smithsonian, Vanguard Records, the Miami Herald, plus a number of books published by the Oxford University Press, University of Nebraska Press, Simon & Schuster, Henry Holt, all these cool people.
And us.
I
can't believe it. We got to do a nice little presentation. We're going to put it up on the website for download. It's a little bit faster than you can actually stream across, unless you have a T1 connection running into your house. So we'll put it up there for a zipped up file, and you can unzip it and download it and run it on your local machine. A lot of fun. Three minutes and 30 seconds. So we have nice big plaques.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, big heavy plaques. They were
Particle board
plaques.
Yes.
And fiberglass embedded stuff on the front.
Yes.
And then these little gold medals that say ASCAP Award and red ribbons that they're attached to.
And the snacks.
Oh, and the snacks that you got and I didn't. And you didn't bring a doggy bag.
I wasn't prepared. I didn't have any baggies. I'll never do that again.
Oh, well, I hope not. All right. Well, that's enough adulation.
Self-flagellation.
Self-flagellation for one day. Let's listen to some more from our new collection of CDs that came to us from Moscow this week. From Electroshock Records. This is Electroshock Presents Electroacoustic Music Volume 6. We presented stuff from earlier volumes of that series. This is by Yuka Rutomaki. This is called, well, it's an homage to one of our favorite characters, Homage à Winston Smith by Yuka Rutomaki. Music from
The Hearts of
Russia. Actually, it sounds like Finnish composer Jukka Rutamäki. Homage to Winston Smith. That from Electroshock Presents Electroacoustic Music, Volume 6. Just arrived.
Was that before Room 101 or after Room 101?
It sounded like a progress through as Winston Smith slowly develops a little tear in his eye that falls down, and he learns that he, in fact, loved Big Brother.
And the mouse.
Yes. What do you got?
From a CD we played before, Sonic Circuits 8. This is by Michael Hosh, Colatudes, 3 short music concrete studies. And the sources are empty Coca-Cola cans, bottles, bottle caps, and other things run through a 4-track variable speed tape cassette recorder.
Cool.
Could be. Michael, what did I say? Hosh, Colatudes. It's so cute. It's so cute. Colitudes by Michael Hosh. Three short music concrete studies.
Oh, that's good. Liked it.
Yes. See, you can do lots of things on a variable speed cassette recorder. Cassettes are not passé. I like that sound. Don't do that. There's nothing like a little tape hiss. They make my blood like cockles.
Yes. Forgotten themes.
We have forgotten themes today.
This is a CD by Artemy Artemyev, again from our new collection that just arrived from Moscow. This is an odd thing. It's
no.
Yeah, it certainly is. Well, let's play one. This is a cut called Calvary. This is a piece from 1989 by Artemy Artemyev. Here it is from Forgotten Themes.
Thank you.
Calvary, music by Artemy Artemyev, that from his new Forgotten Themes CD.
I didn't forget that theme. I've heard it before.
You'll remember it.
Wow, 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 wow. Yes, fine.
One more of his variations on I Am a Poor, a Wayfaring Stranger, American folk song by Artemy Artemyev. So this will be interesting to hear how this works itself out.
A going out tune.
See you next week. This is Calvis and Damien. Next week, we don't know what we're doing.
We don't know.
Good. What nothing like do? It. Here it is. I Am a Poor Wayfaring Stranger, arranged, composed, whatever, by Artemy Artemyev. A production of Baltic Media.